Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with historian Ilan Pappe, and we're going to be talking about his latest book, The Idea of Israel, A History of Power and Knowledge. Opening the show up, I want to welcome back Carl Dix. Carl is a founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network and a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And we're going to talk with Carl about the latest verdict in the Freddie Gray case, where the cop who drove the van that gave Freddie Gray a rough ride that ended up with Freddie Gray dead in a hospital. Carl, how are you?
I'm doing fine, Michael. I'm outraged, but I'm also organizing right now for an actual revolution, and that's what I need to be doing and want to be doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's jump into this, Carl. Let's talk about this latest pig to get off.
Yeah, I mean, we need to talk about this because, look, this was a modern Dred Scott decision for a modern-day lynching. The modern-day lynching was the savage murder of Freddie Gray that was perpetrated by those cops, six of them, last year in Baltimore. And why I call it a modern-day Dred Scott decision, your listeners may remember the Dred Scott decision that the U.S. Supreme Court made in 1857, that black people had no rights that white people are bound to respect. Well, by this court coming to a decision that Officer Goodson was not guilty of any criminal conduct for his role in the murder of Freddie Gray, on top of having exonerated earlier one of the arresting officers and having a hung trial in one of the other officers, they are essentially declaring that black people have no rights that this system's police are bound to respect. That's why I call it a modern-day Dred Scott decision. They're saying their cops can savagely beat you, brutalize you, and even murder you and get off with no punishment whatsoever.
It's so enraging, man. You think about this. Now, I was reading something that was on the RevCom.us site in the Revolution newspaper part of it. The opening paragraph said, "For the crime of making eye contact with a Baltimore cop and then moving off the scene, Freddie Gray was illegally arrested. By the time the pigs were done with him, they had cut his spine and put him on his deathbed. And today the court sets him all three." And when you think about that, that in the shortest, most concise, and most powerful way actually lays out exactly what they did. I think this thing about the Dred Scott decision, extremely important. And it's important that people realize that these cops murdered this man in cold blood. He was arrested for doing nothing but being a black man in Baltimore at that time in that area.
Yeah, and see, they are using this decision in a lot of different ways. Among the people most directly affected by this kind of police terror, they are telling them, "We will do this to you. Our courts will exonerate our law enforcement officers when they do it, and there's nothing you can do in the face of it." And then more broadly in society, they're saying, "Well, look, I know a lot of people were concerned about how Freddie Gray died, but these officers, three of them so far, have had fair trials and were found to be not guilty. So don't worry about it." And what disappears in this is the life and death of Freddie Gray. They even have people believing that what happened was he did this to himself, because that was the defense argument that this judge accepted, that Freddie Gray was responsible for his own death. If he had just remained in the position that the cops put him in, with his hand cuffed behind him and his legs shackled, everything would have been okay. Well, how can someone break their own spine, especially when they're hogtied and shackled like that? It is just physically impossible. These cops subjected him to savage beating, horrific bouncing around in the van. But because they've gone through legal proceedings that don't confirm that, we're supposed to believe that it didn't happen that way. And that's the most despicable thing about it. And now there's even talk of not even bothering to try the remaining cops, the three cops who haven't gone on trial and the one cop who had a hung jury. They're talking about not even going through with those trials because the first three trials have failed to produce convictions. So maybe there's no point in even going through with it. And that underscores two things. One is the crucial importance of people resisting, because the only reason there are any trials in this case is because people stood up and resisted. And if they don't make real clear that it's unacceptable to not even bother to try these cops, they may drop the rest of the charges anyway. The other thing it underscores is the utter illegitimacy of this system and the need to get rid of it through revolution as soon as possible, to end horrors like this and all the other horrors it brings down, from the oppression of black people overall to the subjugation that women face in this society, the attacks on our immigrant sisters and brothers, wars for empire, the violence and bigotry directed at lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people, all of it. It's going to take revolution, nothing less, to end it once and for all. And we in the Revolutionary Communist Party are organizing right now for an actual revolution at the soonest possible time to sweep this away.
All right, Carl, is there anything else you want to add? Because we've got to kind of rush through now, but is there anything else you want to add on the before we leave?
Well, the only thing I'd say is people really need to go to the website, revcom.us. We did a lot of coverage of this trial as it went along, both what was happening in the trial, but also what it means that this stuff is happening. And people really need to dig into that and then put it in the context of the exoneration after exoneration after exoneration of killer cops all across the country, most without trials. But even when they do charge killer cops, charging a killer cop isn't justice. I mean, indict, convict, send the killer cops to jail. There are other steps that have to go down in that. Mm-hmm. So people need to go to revcom.us.
All right, Carl Dix, thank you very much. And I'm sure we'll be talking to you again real soon.
Okay, thank you for having me on, Michael.
All right, take care now. All right, we're not going to take a musical break right now, but we are going to jump right into the interview with Ilan Pappé. So check this out. All right, I'm very pleased to welcome to the show Ilan Pappé. We're talking with Ilan Pappé about his new book, The Idea of Israel, A History of Power and Knowledge. And Ilan has been described as Israel's bravest, most principled, most incisive historian, and that's by John Pilger. Since its foundation in 1948, Israel has drawn on Zionism, the movement behind its creation, to provide a sense of self and political direction. In this groundbreaking new work, Ilan Pappé looks at the continued role of Zionist ideology. The Idea of Israel considers the way Zionism operates outside of the government and military in areas such as the country's education system, media, and cinema, and the uses that are made of the Holocaust in supporting the state's ideological structure. In particular, Ilan Pappé examines the way successive generations of historians have framed the 1948 conflict as a liberation campaign, creating a foundation myth that went unquestioned in Israeli society until the 1990s. Pappé himself was part of the post-Zionist movement that arose then. He was attacked and received death threats as he exposed the truth about how Palestinians have been treated and the gruesome structure that links the production of knowledge to the exercise of power. The Idea of Israel is a powerful and urgent intervention in the war of ideas concerning the past and the future of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Once again, I am really pleased to be welcoming to the show Ilan Pappé. And Ilan Pappé is a professor of history at the University of Exeter. His many books include The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine and most recently Gaza in Crisis with Noam Chomsky. He writes for, among other publications, The Guardian and the London Review of Books. All right, Ilan Pappé, welcome back to the show, man. Good to talk with you again.
It's a pleasure to be on the show, Michael.
I want to jump right into this because I got so much to ask you about. The book is an amazing book, as I was just saying. The Idea of Israel, A History of Power and Knowledge. And the one thing that really jumped at me is you could have written about anything, but you chose to write specifically about the idea of Israel. Why?
Because I wrote enough, I felt like, about the real history of the place, the motives of the sides involved in the conflict and so on. And I was really troubled since 2010 by more the questions of how the history and the reality is being commodified, how it is being sold to people. And then it occurred to me that a successful kind of propaganda or PR campaign, even about a conflict, even about issues of justice and morality, starts with an idea. I mean, you need to have something powerful as an idea to sell to people, to manipulate people's minds with. And that idea can either reflect quite clearly the reality or can be a very far cry from the reality. And I think the latter case really was the case of Israel and the way its history and the reality on the ground have been commodified or sold to people throughout the years.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that struck me, though, as I was reading it and thinking about it later, one of the things that really struck me was that this carries with it a lot of very serious consequences, because it's not just talking about, you know, okay, it's commodified and all this kind of stuff, but actually what you dig into there and what's revealed in what you do is something that indicates that there's very serious consequences for millions of people.
I agree. I do agree. I mean, ideas like historical narratives, ideas can be very benign, can be people's kind of conceptualizing about reality, having an idea about life and so on. These are individuals, and not much can happen. Whether they're good or bad ideas doesn't matter. But when ideas have powerful political movements behind them, and those political movements transform into powerful states with strong military and lethal weapons in their arsenal and so on, these ideas become a nightmare. When they have a story that victimizes other people, or whether the story that the idea carries with it is a story of annihilation, dispossession, or ethnic cleansing. So yes, I think you're right. It's almost like something very simple, which is an idea, and a very terrible reality that that idea can create. Of course, there are ideas that also transform people's life in a better way and in a more peaceful way. But the kind of idea I was interested in is really the idea that has its victims as much as it has its benefactors.
I get a sense in reading it that you felt that there was a real urgency around digging into all this now.
You're absolutely right. There is this unbearable gap, for me at least, between what people know today about Palestine and Israel. And in fact, there is even a gap between what people feel about Israel and Palestine, not just know about Israel and Palestine on the one hand, and the indifference of the political elites around the world, the governments, the economic and military establishment to that reality. I felt that if we are not going to sort of address this gap between presentation, if you want, or representation, and the reality itself, the gap will grow and it will be very difficult to reconnect people to the reality on the ground. It's almost like mirror image, the way mainstream media, mainstream academia, political elites in the West, the way they depict the situation in Israel and Palestine, and probably also in other places in the world, or other situations in the world, and the reality itself. And had it only been a disagreement between me as an individual and those powerful actors, I wouldn't mind that much. But this is a disagreement between millions and millions of people who care about what goes on here when we talk about Israel and Palestine, and the powers that be. I mean, this is a gap between society and government, society and politics. And I'm sure it is not only on the case of Israel and Palestine. I can think about many other issues facing us today as a human society in 2016. Where this gap appears. But of course, for me, it was urgent to deal with the place I was born in and it's very dear to me.
And also, if you look at this in terms of the sense of urgency, one thing that really struck me is that, you know, we're living in a period where over the last few years, what has been going on in relation to the Palestinian people in Gaza in particular, but then also the whole question of the settlements and what's happening in the West Bank and all of this, that this is all seems to be coming to a head. And there's one narrative that's being put out there and it keeps constantly being hit at. And that's the narrative that actually puts the Palestinian people as sort of, look, these are people that are basically pretty much a problem. And they're a problem not just to the Israelis, they're a problem to the world, and that Israel is simply trying to defend itself. You know, you think about this. Think about what happened when Sanders here, one of the candidates for the Democratic presidential nomination, he didn't say a whole lot that was really, you know, something that was like, oh my God, was he really saying that about Palestine? He did not go and address AIPAC as one of the, you know, the leading representatives of the Israeli government and the Zionist movement. He didn't go, but he sent his comments. He sent comments to them. And then he gets in the debate with Hillary Clinton and he simply says, that in so many words that, look, the Palestinian people need to be treated as human beings, and we have to pay attention to that. And that caused a storm of upheaval in terms of people attacking him and all this stuff. So you think about this in terms of the urgency around digging into all this has, I think, is definitely connected with something is brewing in relation to the whole question of Palestine and Israel.
I totally agree with you, Michael. And I think what we are both sort of motivated by is that this is not a complex case that you can sort of excuse people by, let's say, people who are candidates or presumptive candidates for presidency in the United States, for having kind of an ambivalent attitude towards it, or people in the street would say, you know, it's a complex story, there are two sides to the story, and so on. This is a clear case of a victimizer and a victim, a clear case of an oppressor and an oppressed. One of the clearest cases, by the way, in the last decades. And in fact, for the common person in the street who is not fed only by mainstream media but uses alternative media or has been here, this is very clear. And when you have this clear kind of reality of oppression, of victimization, of discrimination, and yet the powers that be through the media, through their political speeches, through their official positions, claim that, in fact, it's almost the opposite, namely the Palestinians are the terrorists and the Israelis are the poor victims, it drives you mad. It really drives you mad, first of all, on the level of how do you deal with it? How do you deal with this fabrication? How do you deal with this distortion? It's not a fine-tuning to reality. This is total distortion of the reality. But I want to add another layer to our conversation. I think what it really motivates at least young people nowadays in many societies around the world to be galvanized around the idea of boycotting Israel and really taking a more active role on behalf of Palestine is that they know that most of the people who convey this false narrative of what goes on in Israel and Palestine know that it is false. That really gets them, the hypocrisy. It would be something else if you would say, wait a minute, these people were educated in a certain way. These people don't have an access to the information that we do, or they have too much on their mind, and that's why they don't know. You know, if you could excuse this as an ignorance, but you know it's not ignorance. It's a cynical, hypocritical position by people who know very well that people in Gaza have very little chance of surviving 2020. They know that on a daily basis, Palestinians lose their homes and their life in the West Bank, and that Palestinians inside Israel are being discriminated in a system that is not far from apartheid South Africa. They know it. By the way, we also know it because people like me speak to their representatives, let's say the American government. We speak to the consuls here. We speak to the attachés. We speak to the diplomats on the ground, and they tell us. We send reports that reflect the reality, the very same way as you describe that reality, but they choose to ignore it. And let me add to this something else. This is not, has not begun today. In 1948, if you look very carefully, as I did, at the original reports American journalists have sent from Palestine during 1948, describing what can only be defined as an ethnic cleansing, a mass expulsions of Palestinians, we know that the editors chose not to publish these reports. And a similar attitude was taken by the International Red Cross and the United Nations. The international community knew already in 1948 that the Palestinians were victims to what can only be described as a crime against humanity. And they decided, because of reasons we may go into it a bit later, for reasons that had to do with the Holocaust and other historical circumstances, that they do not want to publicly accuse the new Jewish state, as they don't want to accuse Israel today, of a policy that if they admit that this is the Israeli policy and strategy, they would have to treat it as a pariah state.
Yeah, it's extremely important, and we will get into that in a minute. One of the things I wanted that was brought up to me, actually, even as you're speaking, is this, a point that you make in the book, where you basically talk about the challenging the idea of Israel, the very idea of Israel, which you write about, which is why I kept thinking about, it's an interesting take on this to actually go after the idea of Israel. But in doing that, you have to challenge the entire narrative of all of the Western imperialist countries, and including, you know, particularly the U.S., you really have to challenge the whole way that they present what they are doing in the world, not just what Israel is doing in the world, but what they are doing in the world as well. And that's a pretty heavy-duty thing to take on, man, and important.
Yeah, and I think it's not just taking them on or challenging their current policies, but also the way that they deal with their own past. And this is where the two case studies of Israel and the United States is so interesting, as two case studies of settler colonialism. Settler colonialism, both in the United States or in North America and in Palestine, was a project of colonization carried out by people who were basically persecuted and expelled from Europe. So these were victims of European culture, religion, and politics who found themselves in someone else's homeland and wanted to turn that homeland to their own, as your listeners probably know what happened in North America in this respect. But the interesting thing is that they claim that this annihilation of the natives, whether they were Native Americans or Native Palestinians, that this annihilation was part of the project of enlightenment, of modernization, of improving humanity. And I think that the same logic, if you want, or not logic, rather the same justification, is behind American policy in Iraq in 2003, even American policy today in Syria, and definitely behind Israel's own policy. And this is connected to the history of ideas of Europe, the European history of ideas. And I think that's one of the reasons I chose also idea, because usually when we teach in, and I've taught in several Western universities and also in Israel, when we teach the history of, if you want, the Western history of ideas, it's always positive ideas, right? You know more or less a century in which democratic ideas emerged, moral philosophy emerged, liberalism, socialism, and so on. So ideas are always kind of a human conceptions that produce takes on reality that really improved people's life. This is only true for Europeans. It's not even true for all the Europeans. I would doubt whether it was good for all the workers in Europe, but that is, put that one aside. And the name of these very progressive ideas, horrific crimes, were committed about anyone who was outside of Europe. And this is exactly, again, quite a simple story that is totally wiped out, expunged from the discussion of the relationship between Europe and the rest of the West and the rest of the world, between the West and Islam, the West and the Arab world and Africa and so on. So Palestine, yes, I think you're right. What happened in Palestine and the way we understand what happened in Palestine is not just about the Palestinians and the Zionist movement. It's about the Western colonialism and imperialism in the past, but also in the relationship in the world today at present.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you also have this particular thing in relation to Palestine and Israel and what's been happening there since 1948, even before that. This whole question of, it's always presented as Zionism is, it's a movement, it's an expression of truth, it's an expression of the will of a people. It's this untouchable and impossible to really get a handle on phenomenon. And you actually spend a lot of time basically saying, look, this is like everything else. Zionism is an ideological question. It's an ideology. And on that basis, that it's open to criticism and it has to be criticized. And I think that's something that, one, is extremely important in terms of getting this, basically the kind of move that needs to be taken in relation to this internationally, but also in terms of even being able to unleash people's thinking in a bigger sense about what the hell is going on there now.
Absolutely. One of the reasons we were distanced from such a critical discussion, and I agree with you. It's at the moment you convince people this is ideology, then you can start discussing its merit, its effect, its practice, not just its theory. But for many years, and for many people probably still today, there was a kind of shield that protected Zionism from such a discussion. And that shield was equating Zionism with Judaism. They're saying this is not ideology, this is a faith, a religion, a monotheistic religion, which is something that people believe in, and if you attack that, you belong to that group of people who attacked Jews just because they were Jews, namely anti-Semitism. So the second equation is not Judaism and Zionism, but anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. I can't think about any other ideology in, you know, in the free world when you discuss it. People tell you, wait a minute, this ideology is immune from such a discussion, because the moment you criticize it, you are the worst racist that one can find. You know, it's almost like saying this is a taboo, this is sacred, and so on. Now, how can ideology that believed in the right to colonize someone else's land be a sacred ideology? You can agree with it, you can disagree, you can say everybody else was doing it. I'm open to all these discussions. What I don't accept is this immunity, this sense that, and believe me, I know it from my personal experience, I paid a high price for this. You are really are treated as someone who is violated the most sacred kind of ideas of humanity if you started criticizing Zionism within Israeli universities. I lost my job because of that. And I can't think of a similar case. So I thought that there must be something, it must be a very successful project that you could have sold or commodified an ideology as something which should be untouchable, should be a taboo. I think it's changing, by the way. I'm optimistic. I don't think we'll stay there forever. But until now, to this very moment, many people would still regard it in such a bizarre way.
Well, you know, one of the things that struck me, too, is, and this is sort of a hallmark of your work, everything that I've read by you and when we've talked before in the past, there's a point here that I was thinking about in relation to you in terms of methodologically, and in particular, in terms of epistemology. You put meaning and weight behind the term social scientist, and that you actually take a scientific approach, but also epistemologically, you're not afraid to look at what's true. And that, I think, is something that's extremely important. And how you saw that in relation to, in particular, I mean, look, 1948, we all know the movies, the stories, the whole thing that's everywhere, and particularly in this country as well as for sure in Palestine, Israel, other places. It's beaten into your head, the stories of the brave Jewish people who were recovering from this just inhuman and horrible thing that happened to them by the Nazis and da-da-da-da and all this stuff. But epistemologically, people are encouraged more to close their eyes and listen to what the narrative is, listen to what the story is, listen to that, and not really insisting on. And there's not enough people, I think, insisting on the epistemology you have to employ has to be one that looks for truth, no matter what it is, because you can't know anything without having the truth.
I totally agree. And I think what really got me sort of going from very early on is that how visible this truth is. You know, it was not really hidden in classified archives. It was not kept in a vault in Port Knox. It was there for everyone to see if they just wanted to open their eyes. You cannot wipe out 500 Palestinian villages in 1948 and kind of wipe them out of memory, or wipe them out of people's cognition or awareness. There are even physical remnants for such an act. You cannot destroy the whole urban space of Palestine that was there for hundreds of years and claim that it never existed. The only people who could be so blind to these visible remnants are people who have put these dark ideological glasses on their eyes and then they can't see it. But I was less interested in those people who lived here and refused to see what was so obvious to me. And I think that part of what motivated me writing that book was I was interested, but why everybody else is wearing these glasses, using the same metaphor, wearing these dark glasses. How come they too are unable to call a spade when it's so obvious and so clear? And I really thought that, as you know, the book claims that there are two mechanisms for human society or human mind today that complement each other and can create a powerful conviction in a lie, in a society that pretends to be open. Because, of course, in dictatorial societies, you just have to use intimidation and fear, and people would believe whatever you want them to believe. But I was talking about a society that allegedly is open. So you don't use intimidation. You don't force people to see something that they don't see. This is something much more subtle. And I claim in the book that the two means that complement each other is, on the one hand, allegedly scientific research, namely you bring academic scholarly proof to the lie. You put a lot of footnotes, you recruit your best scholars, and they cheat without either knowingly or unknowingly, doesn't matter. But they really create a false scholarly production of knowledge. But that's not enough. You need the movies. You need the television. Nowadays, probably you need the internet. Doesn't matter. But you need also something fictional to complement the non-fictional proof. And both the film industry and the academia, in this case, were powerful agents of selling a very simple truth as a very complicated lie. The question is, why does it still go on? I mean, with everything we know and all the things we, some of us have already unearthed and disclosed, but for so many people, especially where you're coming from, it still is the biggest fabrication on earth.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Ilan Pappe. And we're talking today with Ilan about his latest book, The Idea of Israel, A History of Power and Knowledge. We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned. Ilan, let's continue along these lines. Because I'd also, when you're raising this, why do people get away with this? There is one thing that comes up all the time, and it's both because of the truth of this in terms of the Holocaust and what actually was concentrated in that, what happened and what was concentrated in that. But it's also, it's something that has constantly reached me. You say, I don't understand, how do people keep falling for this stuff? How do they keep allowing this stuff to go on? And the Holocaust has actually been one major gateway for the Zionists to use in terms of justifying everything.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And you can see how, in order to manipulate the Holocaust memory in the service of maintaining the kind of narrative we were talking about, the narrative that is really the mirror image of the reality on the ground, you have to mess with the chronology, first of all. Namely, you create the sense among people that Jews arrived in Palestine after the Holocaust, and that this was the redeeming the Jewish people for the horrible things that happened to them during the Holocaust. Whereas the Zionist colonialist project was already deeply rooted in Palestine before. Palestinians were beginning to lose their homeland and land long before the Holocaust. But you create a different chronology, of course. And secondly, of course, the second thing you create, you absolve Europe from dealing with its own crime against the Jewish people. It was a horrible crime. It was not only, as we all know, it was not only committed by the Nazis. They had a lot of associates all around Central, Eastern, and Western Europe. But they don't have to deal with it because the Zionist movement tells them, you know, we don't have to deal with what you've done to the Jews if you support unconditionally the Jewish colonization of Palestine. And that kind of nexus between a crime committed by Europeans against Jews with a crime the Jews are about to commit against the Palestinians, on a moral, ethical basis, if you put it to people who don't know anything before that, they would be appalled. But within the narrative we're speaking about, suddenly this looks logical. As does the story that people can really knock on your house in Los Angeles and tell you, listen, Michael, I used to live here 2,000 years ago, therefore half of your apartment is mine. And the local policeman will come and says, Michael, sorry, he's right, you know, he's been here 2,000 years ago, so please give him back the house. This is the kind of logics that would not have passed any kind of test of common sense or even the values of enlightenment itself. But nonetheless, sounded logical, commonsensical, and moral through that powerful machine of propaganda.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that comes to mind, just thinking about that right away, off you saying this, is the role of, and I probably will mispronounce this, but is it Mizrahi Jews?
Yeah, Mizrahi Jews.
The role they play in relation to everything, to what's seen as the essence of Israel and how Let's talk about that a little, because that sort of stands out in my mind.
It's very, you know, it's an interesting timing that you ask this question. An old news scandal that erupted in Israel today and yesterday, I'm not sure it's even covered by the international media, but it's a very hot topic here in Israel. Between 48 and 1954, thousands of Yemenite Jewish and Iraqi Jewish children were kidnapped from their parents and given to European Jewish families for adoption. The mothers were told that the babies died. I mean, these were all babies who suffered from, you know, some sort of illness or needed some sort of treatment in hospital, and they would disappear. And then the mother would be told that the baby has died. And only now the families are demanding that the government would open the documents about the kidnap and adoption. The documents are closed until 2075. The government probably thinks that by 2075 nobody would remember what happened. But why do I tell you this story? Because what lies behind this? The idea was that the only way of making sure that these next generation of Jews who came from Yemen and Iraq would be properly Zionists would be to de-Arabize them. So how do you de-Arabize them? You give them to European parents to be raised by Europeans, right? Not by their own families. Yeah. And this was part of a bigger picture of de-Arabization, the whole idea that actually Zionism wanted to create a European colonial state instead of Palestine. But for demographic reasons, it had to do with the Holocaust. They decided also to appeal to Jews in the Arab countries after 48, but they really, the leaders of the Jewish community saw them as Arabs, and they wanted to de-Arabize them by changing their names, by alienating them from their culture and language and roots, which they did successfully, one should say. Most of them were properly de-Arabized, but every now and then, a case like the one I just described to you pops up. So the process is not complete, and as long as we know that this process is not complete, there is some hope, because Palestine and Israel are in the Middle East, are part of the Arab world, they're not part of Europe, they're not part of the West, and the sooner the third generation of Jewish settlers who are now living here, about 5 to 6 million, would realize it, the sooner they would contribute to the stabilization of this whole area and to peace in the world. The longer they insist that they are a European island or Western island in the sea of barbarism, as they put it, the longer they would contribute to the instability and inhumanity in the region.
Mm-hmm. Now, what you're just saying in relation to the Jews that come from Yemen and Iraq and whatnot, what I read in your book was actually stunning in a certain sense in terms of the way that these people were treated, and then also, in a certain sense, their sort of quest to sort of be accepted as full-on citizens and not to be, you know, even to become, even it seemed like you were saying in the book that they were also looking to become sort of Jewish in relation to all this, you know? I mean, they are Jewish. They have the Jewish religion, but they were looking to be really fully accepted as that same equal in the same kind of oppressive, you know, designation, the same kind of repressive situation in the entire place. One of the things that really struck me, though, too, is that if you look at that in relation to the Palestinians, because none of this is open to the Palestinians, and I mean, maybe it's obvious to everybody, but I think it's worth talking about a little bit. There's a reason why the Palestinians and the whole question of the Palestinian population that driven out of their homeland. I think it was actually in the latter part of your book where you talk about the actual plans for the West Bank and the, you know, that some of these groups have the plans to actually take over most of the West Bank to make it as part of Israel and to take over, you know, other parts of the country and to actually make sure that the Palestinian people are more or less erased.
Absolutely. That's why I'm very impressed by a new kind of wave, if you want, among young academics who study Palestine around the world, which sort of relates more hermetically to the paradigm of settler colonialism, looking more closely at Zionism as settler colonialism, because settler colonialism inherently has this logic of annihilation that you're talking about. The settler colonialist project is based on this logic that if you come to someone else's homeland and you want to make it not just a home, but your own homeland, you have to get rid of that someone, namely the native indigenous population. The means of doing it vary from one case study to the other and vary according to the periods in which we are talking. So in 2016, getting rid of the native population would not be done in the same means, through the same means it was done in 17th century North America. But the logic is still the same logic. And in simple terms, as I say in the book, it's the idea is that you can never feel that your project of creating a Jewish state in Palestine is complete until you have as much of historical Palestine as possible and as few Palestinians in it as possible. This is shared by the vast majority of the Jewish political parties and movements inside Israel. So that's why I struggle in the book to show that my fear of Zionism really is not motivated by any anti-Semitism, not just because I'm a Jew, but because it's nothing to do with anti-Semitism. It's my fear for my Palestinian friends, brothers and sisters. That's my fear. My fear is that this ideology, even in its most, in its softer variants, leaves no hope for existence to the Palestinians. This is my struggle. My struggle is to save what remains of Palestine and what remains of the Palestinians. Of course, it's not my own struggle. It's everybody else's struggle. But I think kind of shedding light of where the danger comes from and saying this is not just one messianic, fanatic, right-wing group in Israel that constitute this danger. It is this whole ideology is based on the elimination of the Palestinians, and it's not too late for both sides to choose another ideological way forward. It will not be the only case in history where people realized that a certain ideology became irrelevant, dangerous, and needed to be rethought, and substituted by a more humane approach to life. I do hope that there will be enough people on both sides, of course, that would be able to push forward that ideology.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Ilan Pappe. And we're talking today with Ilan about his latest book, The Idea of Israel, A History of Power and Knowledge. Now, one of the things in relation to all this, you have a situation where there's a grouping of people called the New Historians, and you yourself are included, I assume, in among that group as a new historian. And it gets into what you've been talking about. I mean, even telling the truth about who are the various forces in the society, what role do they play in the society? Yourself and other new historians are critical to actually people being able to understand this is not just aimed at Jewish people in Israel. It's not just aimed at the Palestinian people. It's aimed at the world in terms of actually being able to explain, look, where did all this come from? And it challenges, and I think one of the challenges from the very beginning that had to be intense, and again gets back to the epistemological, methodological approach we were talking about earlier, it challenges from the very beginning the whole focus of what actually did happen in 1948. What was going on there, and what's the importance of people understanding the truth about that? So I'd like to talk about that a little bit, including letting people know what does it mean to be a new historian?
Yeah, definitely. First of all, we should mention in this connection that the Palestinian historians, long before the emergence of the new history in Israel, were telling different stories to the Zionist story about what happened in 1948. And some of them were these very early historians, even experienced it themselves. So it was very, very interesting that the international community needed critical Israeli historians to corroborate the Palestinian narrative, if you want, to accept that actually the common Israeli story about what happened in 1948 was a fabrication. And I think what the new historians did, that they really used very well the documents that became only available in the 1970s and the 1980s and provided a more kind of scholarly infrastructure for the Palestinian narrative, and later on Palestinian historians themselves used oral history and their own archives to even expand the picture more. But again, like as we sort of covered in our conversation from the very beginning, it was really the gap between a simple, unfortunate story of inhumanity and a presentation of that story as something complex and something very difficult to grasp. And the simple story was that 48 provided an historical opportunity for the settler colonialist movement of Zionism to try and push dramatically forward its chances of taking over as much of Palestine as possible and leaving in it as few Palestinians as possible. I won't go into the background for this, but 48 did provide that historical juncture. And they did try within 9 months through the year of 1948 to complete the job, but did not succeed. We should also say that. There was Palestinian resistance. There was a limit to their capacity. But they did expel half of Palestine's population. They made half of the country's population refugees within 9 months. We're talking about Syria and Iraq today, and we are flabbergasted by what's going on there. But we have to remember what happened in Palestine in 48. 500 villages were destroyed within 9 months. 12 towns were demolished within 12 months. I mean, this was quite a drastic change of the reality in Palestine that escaped the radar of international morality. And I think what the new historians did, they said, listen, even the Israeli documents tell us that this was what happened. And you cannot really have the story that Israel spent since 48 being accepted anymore, the story of the Palestinians voluntarily leaving their houses to be demolished and the towns to be destroyed, and half of the population decides, oh, let's move out for whatever reason, which is unthinkable and never happened. So I think it was providing scholarly scaffolding, if you want, to a moral position which the Palestinians had held since 48. And together, I think it made a powerful counter-argument that at least in certain academic, journalistic, and political circles today is accepted, although not yet where it is really important in the corridors of power.
Mm-hmm. Well, now tell me this, because I think this is related to this, but it's also a little bit different. You also talk a lot about what's known as the post-Zionist historians. Let's talk about that, because on one hand, it's like sort of who and what they are, but also there was a certain upheaval that they helped instigate in terms of really uncovering some truth about what was the history of Israel and also what's currently going on. So who are, and what were their shortcomings as well, the post-Zionist historians?
Yeah. Well, in the 1980s, Israeli academics, playwrights, journalists, educators, people who dealt with knowledge about the past and the present, began to liberate themselves from the official narrative, the Zionist narrative, in various ways, each one according to his or her interest in life, whether they were artists or filmmakers or academics. And together, they really undermined some of the basic truisms of Zionism, not just the 48 war. That this is the time where Mizrahi Jews began to question the way that they were treated in the 50s. Palestinian citizens of Israel went back to the days of the military rule and exposed and understood better the way they are treated today in an ethnic Jewish state. The same happened to women. This is the days where sort of feminism asks itself also whether Zionism is a misogynist, kind of chauvinist movement, or does it really, as it pretends to be, has a feminist agenda in it. So I think all in all, what happened was that anyone who was either a fool or a partial victim of Zionism, if you want, in one way or another, or anyone who chose to speak on behalf of these victims, found a way of expressing this concern in a way that potentially could have affected the culture, the educational system, and maybe, who knows, even the political system. But it was very short-lived, this kind of era of criticism. I would say the 1990s was the decade when it happened. And the second intifada, the second uprising, the alleged war against terror in the United States that fused very well with the alleged Israeli war against terror has silenced many of these critics. Some of them did a U-turn and made a kind of a mea culpa, asking for forgiveness for their criticism in the past. Others left the country. And so far, we can't see any impact of that ideological upheaval in Israeli politics. Although I must say, in the civil society in Israel, on a small scale, though, you can see the beginning of an NGO culture that is post or even anti-Zionist that wasn't there before. especially among young people. It's very limited. It's very, it's just burgeoning. It just emerges, but it has the potential of causing, in the long run, maybe even a more powerful change from within.
Mm-hmm. We have about 13 more minutes left, and there's two questions I want to get into. And one is, again, I want to explore a little bit more what you raised about the role of the Second Intifada, because it seems that like what happened there actually began to change everything. Can we talk about that a little?
Yeah, definitely. You have to remember the Second Intifada comes after the Oslo process. Now, I have a lot of criticism about the Oslo process. I don't think it was a genuine peace process. I don't think it was a successful peace process. But nonetheless, it created a decade in the 1990s where Israelis and Palestinians began to talk to each other and talked about everything, including the very essence of Zionism. And that, I think, also contributed to the critique we defined earlier on as Zionist. And in many ways, with or without the Second Intifada, it was clear, now I understand it historically as I write in the book, that it was either premature, I mean, the Israeli Jewish society was unwilling, actually, to go along this kind of criticism, fearing that it would lead, as it would have, to question the very origins of the state, the very identity and justification for the state, which happened anyway, by the way, but they decided they don't want to see it happening from within. It happened from outside, as we know. And secondly, there was a fear that the message to the Palestinian was that there is still a hope for changing the reality on the ground. And I think it was very important for the Israeli military establishment to use every available weapon they had to send the message. They themselves said it. One of the chief of general staff put it. They wanted to engrave the idea of defeat, to root the idea of defeat in the Palestinian psyche, so that they would have no hope for changing their reality through, by any means, peaceful or non-peaceful. So I think that, unfortunately, in a way, by being critical of the very essence of Zionism, we contributed, unintentionally, of course, to the emergence of a worse version of Zionism, which I call in the book Neo-Zionism, which is far worse as far as the Palestinians are concerned, because it believes now that they have a struggle, an existential struggle, and that they have a window, a historical window of opportunity in which to complete the project of taking over the whole of Palestine. And this is why they really do not give a damn about what the world is saying. This is why they can appoint someone like Lieberman as a minister of defense. This is why they allow themselves to disregard any rebuke that even comes officially from the EU or from President Obama, let alone the fact that they have some very strong supporters in the United States anyway, still today, as we know, not only in the Republican Party. But this is the essence of the Second Intifada. It was much more, people usually regard the Second Intifada as a Palestinian mistake by resorting to an armed struggle again against a powerful enemy that really undermined Palestine's position in the world. I think they get it wrong. The Palestinians continued to struggle against Zionism from 1882. So the struggle was an anti-colonialist struggle that continues, and continues also in the 21st century. What happened in 2000 was not the Second Intifada. What happened in 2000 was the Israelis' decision to escalate the military operations in order to complete the job that they have left half done in 1948.
So, Ilan, in relation to what you've just been talking about with the neo-Zionists, one of the things that really struck me in reading about it is that this is a movement that not only has dedicated itself to sort of going against and trying to erase any of the impact of the other historian movements, including the post-Zionist historians, all of this, but it also, it seems to be a tact that's being taken of like, so yeah, everything you say about the problems, everything you say about what happened, it's all true, but you have to see it in a different light. We're not going to argue about whether or not this or this happened. Yes, it happened, but it happened for a good reason. And it seems to be different.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And this is why one wants to watch very carefully to see whether the gap between the reality and the fabrication would continue now that the kind of hegemonic ideological take inside Israel does not deny the policy of oppression, of colonization and expulsion, but just justifies it morally, either on the basis of religion or the basis of nationalism. So I think their take is that actually it's much better not to lie, if you want, or to fabricate the reality, but rather to accept the fact that maybe in the world of 2016 you can secure an international assurance for such policies, because other countries in the world, like Saudi Arabia and others, have their own baggage of violations of human rights and civil rights, and they are part of the community of civilized nations. So why do we have to play that game? So I think this is a very important point, that there is a demand for accepting the morality of the facts that were denied by, if you want, the classical Zionists. Mm-hmm. So factually, there is an agreement about what happened and what's happening. The debate now is only on a moral, ethical basis. And the question to the world now would be, not who's right and who's wrong in terms of facts, but which moral position do you take with regard to the reality?
All right, Ilan Pappé, thank you very much for joining us today, man. It's been a great time talking with you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Michael.
Take care.
Thank you. Okay. Bye. Bye-bye.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Ilan Pappé. Ilan's latest book is The Idea of Israel, A History of Power and Knowledge. I think this is an extremely important book for anyone who's concerned about the emancipation of humanity and what's going on in Israel in relation to the Palestinian people and what that means for the rest of us in the rest of the world. All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistants, Jeff Pryor, Alex Benner, and Matt Kwiklinski. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. All right, we're going to go out now with another piece from Just Siri X, and this one is Checkpoint, inspired by his trip to Palestine.
Journal of the hard times, tales from the dark side, evidence of the settlements on my hard drive. Man, I swear my heart died at the end of that car ride when I saw that checkpoint. Welcome to apartheid. Soldiers wear military green at the checkpoint. Automatic guns, that's machine at the checkpoint. Tables not M16s at the checkpoint. Fingers on the trigger, you get leaned at the checkpoint. Little children, grown adults and teens at the checkpoint. All your papers better be clean at the checkpoint. Gotta put your finger on the screen at the checkpoint and pray that red light turns green at the checkpoint. And Martin Luther King had a dream at the checkpoint. He wake with loud screams from the scenes at the checkpoint. Is Malcolm X by any means at the checkpoint? Imagine if your daily routine was the checkpoint.
And Martin Luther King had a dream at the checkpoint. He wake with loud screams from the scenes at the checkpoint. Is Malcolm X by any means at the checkpoint? Imagine if your daily routine was the checkpoint.
Separation walls that surround in the checkpoint. On top is barbed wire like a crown on the checkpoint. Better have your permit if you found at the checkpoint. Gumming on the tower, aiming down at the checkpoint. Idea is to keep you in fear at the checkpoint. Enter through the cage in the rear of the checkpoint. Feels like prison on a tear at the checkpoint. I'd rather be anywhere but here at this checkpoint. Nelson Mandela wasn't blind to the checkpoint. He stood for free Palestine at a checkpoint. Support BDS, don't give a dime to the checkpoint. This is international crime at the checkpoint. Arabs get treated like dogs at the checkpoint. Cause discrimination is the law at the checkpoint. Criminalized.